Hello, this is Jesse Liberty, and this is yet another podcast.
Today I'm joined again by John Galloway, my sometimes host. How are you, John?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Glad to have you here. And we have with us Chris Sells, who is an author, a former Microsoft Principal Program Manager, if I have that right, and is now Vice President at Telerik and my boss. Chris?
Yes. Hi. You know that my boss thing you didn't have to throw in right now. Now people are expecting you to go really easy on me during this interview.
And I intend to.
Well, there you go. Now we know.
I'm no fool. What I wanted to do, Chris, if it's okay, is take you back through a little bit of history that you and I lived through with various incarnations of the latest thing at Microsoft.
Sure. And
I believe you told me that one of the places that you started was on the TAPI work. Do I have that right, on the telephony work?
Yes. In fact, when I was at Intel, my first real job, quote unquote, my first job out of college was a bunch of fraternity brothers who got together and formed a little telecommunications value-added reseller named Spanley Communications, and they were acquired by Cisco, which I guess means eventually they won the lottery, right? That's what everyone wants to do. And it was like a part-time job when I was finishing up my bachelor's degree in computer science at the University of Minnesota, and then it was my first job right out of college, and then I got bored there. Having done everything I thought I could ever do there. And I was mad because they hired somebody, you know, to be the director of engineering, and it wasn't, you know, some 19-year-old kid, right? They hired an adult, right? And so I put my resume out on the internet, but not on the web like we do today. I actually uploaded it to an FTP site, which is where you put resumes in those days. And I got a call from Intel. And Intel is the reason I'm in Portland today. I went to Intel in 1992. And at the time, Intel was building telephony boards. And writing software at Intel was an interesting prospect because, unlike, you know, working at Microsoft or most software companies, the job was, how do we build the best software that runs on the computers that people have in their homes and in their businesses today, right? How do we compete against our competitors and make sure we build the best thing we can possibly build? Intel wasn't about that at all. They wanted to build software that took advantage of the next generation of hardware, right? They wanted to build software that ran crappy on today's computers so that you would have to go run out and buy a new computer, right?
Brilliant.
Yeah, and in that case at Intel, right, quality was job two. And so I was busy working on software for the next generation, and they thought at the time that telephony and video conferencing over telephones was going to be the thing that would take off. And so they were busy building hardware boards that would you throw into your computer, and then you'd connect your phone, and it would do things like make it really easy to have a conference call, or make it really easy to transfer a call, or set, you know, your voicemail settings, or, you know, things like that, right? That's what Intel was doing. And so I was writing apps for this piece of hardware. And at Intel, we didn't just build the piece of hardware. We anticipated several pieces of hardware, because at that time, right, it was, wow, just this whole flood of flashback of all of these acronyms from the world of telephony just hit me smack in the forehead. The one off the top of my head is POTS. I don't know. You guys know
telephone POTS service.
Plain old telephone service, absolutely, right? You pick it up, you hear a dial tone. As opposed to, you know, you're talking to various brands and manufacturers of PBX systems, right? Private branch exchanges, which is just a fancy way of saying a switch, right? A telephone switch on site at a company. And so they anticipated building all of these boards, or other third parties building all of these boards, but they wanted the software to run across all of these different PBX systems or plain old telephone services. So they built a middle layer, right? Which is the standard way to solve these problems, right? There is no problem that can't be solved by another layer of software, right? And so they invented the telephony API, TAPI, which eventually Intel talked Microsoft into shipping in Windows, and they did. But at the time, we were developing TAPI which was a middle layer implementation and an API. And then it had an API at the bottom for the telephony service provider. And then we were building the telephony service provider that talked to the device driver that we were building, that talked to the firmware on the hardware, both of which we were building. And so when I was debugging my software, it could be anywhere. It could be in my app. It could be in the API. It could be in the implementation of the API. It could be in the telephony service provider. It could be in the device driver. It could be in the firmware. It was a nightmare, right? Because they were all under development at the same time.
Mm. You remind me of two things very quickly I'll say. First of all, in the small world department, I built a telephony software, piece of software application that was for outbound calling, where the original concept was your train is late and we'll call your boss and let him know. Or your train is late, we'll call home and let them know you're okay, but the train is running late, and later morphed into other uses. But I was immersed in those cards and Cisco firmware and Tappy and all of that for a little while. So very, very strange small world. The other piece that you remind me of is that when I was at Interchange for Ziff Davis, we were building a cross-platform Windows and Mac application using a beta compiler and a beta debugger and an alpha framework, and you would, and using object-oriented C++ that none of us really knew.
Sure.
And you would look at your code and say, now, is it me? Is it the compiler? Is it the debugger? You
know, right.
What is going on? Right.
Well, so it's interesting too that you bring up robo dialing, and that you were building one of the first robo dialing systems, and you of course were doing it for benevolent means, right? Hey, you know, your train is late. I thought you might want to know, as opposed to the current popular use, which is spam advertising via phone numbers, right?
Yes, we were very careful that we only did this with people with whom we had a relationship, as opposed to spamming.
Right. So it's interesting that, as it turns out, I have a patent on that.
Really?
My one and only patent was at Intel, and I have the plaque to prove it. And it is for outbound dialing. Outbound voicemail is what we called it.
Well, on that note, I think we've just closed the circle and we're done.
Well, it's funny. I try not to tell people, right, that you know, that I'm the guy who invented robo-dialing.
You do understand you're on a podcast, and you've now told more than a few people.
This isn't just the three of us? What do you mean?
So that was at Intel. Did you go to Microsoft from Intel?
No, actually. I had kind of a long career between Intel and Microsoft at a little startup training company on the West Coast in Los Angeles called Developmentor.
I did not realize. I knew that you were at Developmentor. I didn't realize that that was a major part of your career.
I was teaching on and off for 8 years and consulting and traveling as a Developmentor employee for kind of a long time. Yes.
There were some extraordinary people at Developmentor. I think you and I have talked about Mike Woodring, who taught me C#, and he was just an amazing instructor from Developmentor. And there were a number of other courses that they did in the Boston area that were just terrific. I never did do one of the Gorilla courses.
The Gorilla courses were some of my favorites. That was a crazy idea that Don had, and he and I gave the first one ever. It was the Gorilla Windows, and we tried to teach people in 60 hours in 5 days, so 12 hours a day. We would teach people that didn't know C++ or Win32 or MFC, all three of those topics. And we would have between 50 and to 100 people in a room, each with their own computer. And these weren't, you know, little laptops, right? These were full tower computers with CRT monitors. So we had to get a room that allowed the air conditioning to be turned up really high. And everyone would listen to Don or I or other Developmentor instructors. Of course, Mike was a Gorilla Windows instructor, and you know, Fritz Onion, Aaron Sconard, Keith Brown, right? The founders of Pluralsight. You know, I could go on and on in terms of the kind of well-known people in the industry who used to teach those Gorilla courses. And we would just riff for 12 hours for 5 days. And then in between the lectures, they would sit down and they would write programs. And we would be there to answer their questions so that they could actually get hands-on experience, 60 hours of hands-on experience so that Monday morning, the next day after they came home, they could be productive Windows programmers.
John, is that what your code camps are like?
No, not at all. They're webcams. So we used to do ones where it was a full day of training followed by a full day hackathon. And I love those because, you know, people would watch us build stuff and then they would go through either like unstructured hackathons where they would compete and try and build something in a day. And then we'd have a competition at the end of the day. Or we'd also do, you know, for people that were kind of newer to it, they would walk through a tutorial or a lab or something. And of course, you know, it's the standard, like you can watch some, everything makes sense when you're watching someone else do it. And then when you try and do it, something's wrong. You misspell something, you don't have something installed, whatever. And that's when you really, you know, actually learn it.
Yes. Yes. And so that's what we did. We'd do 90 minutes of lecture and then 90 minutes of lab. And we would do that alternatively for 60 hours. And then we also had for kind of the, you know, the fast starters, we would have a contest on Thursday night and we'd have people come up and show off whatever cool software they'd built during that week. So we didn't have hackathons at the time and we just did it as part of Guerrilla because we didn't have another name for it.
So I'm curious with those, you were saying that for the training part, you were saying riffing. I mean, was it structured? Were you like, you know, because building an hour or building just a few hours of training can take a lot of time. Building a whole week of training sounds like just a huge investment of time to actually build out courseware unless you're just kind of going.
Yeah. So, you know, when I say riffing, I'm talking about kind of, you know, what happens after the 12 hours that day and everyone is on an adrenaline high from the coding and the fun and the red vines from all day, right? And we keep going until midnight because people don't want to stop. And then, you know, and then we go out to some all night diner or we have, you know, 100 person death matches in Quake, right? Until the wee hours of the morning. And then we get like 3 hours of sleep and we get up and we're there at 9 a.m. doing it all over again the next day. And we do that all week long. And by, you know, by Wednesday, Thursday, right, we're just loopy. The whole room is loopy. And we're just taking requests from the audience of crazy features that they heard about and they want to see us do. And we would, that's what I mean, riff, right? At that point, it would become jazz fusion via the keyboard.
And they gotta reinstate those because I could definitely see 60 hours on Windows 8 programming would be a blast. Although I am way too old for the 22 hour days.
Yeah, so it was a fun experience when you were young, yeah. Right? And it's funny too because at the time, right, I had been programming Windows at Intel since 92, and we started the Guerrillas in 98, I want to say, 96, somewhere in there. So I've been programming Windows for 4 or 5 years, and we tried to cram all of that history and culture and tribal knowledge into 60 hours, right? And so we easily had, I mean, John, you talk about the time it would take to write a formal course for that number of hours, and you're right. I mean, it took us months to write the first one, and then we would constantly, every single time we taught it, we would take down notes and we would rev it and we would update it. And we did that for all of the courseware across all of DevelopMentor. We were always improving it and changing it and replacing things. And we had formal labs for all of them. We had step by step, you know, do this, do this. If you need a hint, here's some code, right? That kind of thing. Here's the solution. If you want to look at that, we had all of that for 60 hours. And then, you know, as we try to cram in all that history, right, for Windows programmers, you know, we would have so much more material that we knew that we couldn't get into the course, but we would kind of squeeze it in, you know, around the edges, right? That kind of thing. People would have a request. What about this thing? What about that thing? And then eventually those requests would turn into whole other courses, right? We had a Guerrilla Comm course that was all about just Comm for 60 hours. And we couldn't get through all of Comm in 60 hours. And we had a Guerrilla Web Programming course, right? Back then when it was just ASP. Right. There was no .NET to go along with it. And of course, then there was Guerrilla.NET. And, you know, it just kind of the format really, really took off. And
let's just roll back for a second. You did say Guerrilla Comm, and Comm was one of those topics that had a hockey stick learning curve. You know, it was the fundamentals were pretty straightforward. And then there was this bend in the learning curve that just knocked people out, as I remember.
Yeah, it was from my point of view. Comm was almost impossible to get started on, until Don wrote the first chapter of Essential Calm, which to my mind is still the best piece of technical writing I've ever read. He managed to take a C++ programmer who understood how C++ worked, show them that they didn't really understand how C++ worked, then show them how C++ worked for real, and then say, and on top of this, we can build an entire binary interoperable object communication protocol. Let me show you that. And then let me show you the root of it all, I am known. And it was the most mind-blowing 30 pages of anything I've ever read.
And you also buddied in your writing with people like Ian Griffiths on WPF.
Absolutely,
And Ian is brilliant and took over my C# book and did an incredible job. But I can't quite imagine what it's like to co-write with him. It must be daunting.
So Ian is incredibly brilliant. He at the time in WPF when we were writing together, I was at Microsoft by that time, and I was at MSDN running a developer center, which was, you know, Microsoft. Hey, here's everything you need to know about a topic to get you started. You know, pointers into the docs and fresh content from third parties and fresh content that I wrote and, you know, this whole kind of, and RSS feeds from specific places on the internet and this whole kind of, you know, budding community. And I was doing it for WPF and Indigo and WebF workflow, Windows Workflow Foundation. And these were the technologies. It was called the Longhorn Dev Center, right? It was before these things were split off from, they were part of the next version of Windows, right? And then they split off into those three technologies that became, you know, parts of the new version of .NET at the time when they were split out of Longhorn. And so I was at Microsoft, right, pulling this content together from a bunch of places, including him. But he was out in the world doing consulting on WPF, doing contracting on WPF, teaching the WPF courses at Develop Mentor, and really understanding WPF. So I had a bunch of ideas and thoughts and concepts from my own WPF knowledge, but he brought all of that kind of community knowledge, right? This is what really happens when the rubber hits the road. And he was super good at that. And so, you know, we brought different skills and different writing styles. And a lot of the things that we spent doing was meshing our two writing styles. So the way we did it was we would just write different chapters en masse, right? I would write chapter one, he would write chapter two, et cetera, right? And then the rule was, and I do this with all my co-authors, the rule was is that the book doesn't ship until everyone who's writing it, both authors, are happy with every single word in the book, right? So I would edit his stuff and give feedback, and he would update it, and he would edit my stuff and give feedback, and I would update it, and we would get down to, you know, these long, I mean, we would stretch the commenting ability inside of Word to its limit by stretching all the way down the columns, right, on literally sometimes phrases or individual words that we had picked that, you know, one person liked and somebody else didn't.
You did ship these books, though, so that's pretty astonishing.
We did. I got my book writing ethic, meaning I don't ship the book until I can't find anything else to fix, from Scott Myers, who, you know, is legendary in the C++ community for effective C++ and more effective C++. Or, you know, as we like to think about it, effective C++, the happy times, and effective C++, the dark times, which is really how those two books shake out. And the first book I ever wrote, I wrote as an update to Scott Myers, and I would ship him. He wrote, it's really funny, he wanted to make money on the kind of internet boom, right? Everyone was writing all these books about the internet as it was coming. And so his idea was to write a tiny little book of how to make Windows 3.1 usable on the internet, which essentially meant, hey, there's all of these file formats on the internet and programs that you needed to surf the internet that didn't come out of the box with Windows. So each one of his books shipped with a floppy disk that provided, you know, the program that would allow you to look at JPEG files, right? Or the program that would allow you to download from FTP sites, right? Because those didn't come out of the box. And then it was a book, an instruction manual that went along with that. And these tiny little books that you would see on the shelf, right next to, you know, the phone book of the listing of all, you know, websites known at the time, right? The internet yellow pages.
Yes.
And he was frustrated because he didn't make any money on it because it was this tiny little book next to this huge heaving shelf filled with enormous books. And so he wanted to make money on the, on Windows 95, right? This huge thing that everyone in the world was super excited about, right? People lined up for a Microsoft product. They lined up around the block and stayed overnight for Windows 95. And I knew that Windows 95 was going to be a hit. When my grandmother, my 85-year-old grandmother said, "Chris, do I need Windows 95? And I said, "Grandma, you don't have a computer." And she said, "I know, but do I need it?" And so, you know, that was what a big hit Windows 95 was, right? And so he wanted to write that, but he didn't know Windows 95. He wasn't interested in learning Windows 95. So he gave it to me. And he said, "Chris, update my book." And so I would send him updates to his work, right? I would find the Windows 95 equivalents of the programs that he was in and the updates and whatever. And I would update the screenshots and write, this was my first book ever. And I would send him updates to the chapter and he would fill the columns with these comments, just these tiny little details. And I'm like, "Oh my God, are you kidding me? This doesn't matter at all." And he's the one who, I mean, this was the volume of comments that he would give back and the details that he would pick at. It's enough to make a grown man cry. And this is how I learned to be a writer. And this is how I learned to be a reviewer of other people's writing, is by working with Scott Myers.
And I have the scars to prove it.
You do. You and all the evangelists at Telerik regularly get Scott Myers routed through me as comments into your writing. Yes. Sorry about that.
Oh, no, you know, it's quite good. John, go
ahead. I wonder, well, I'm thinking, you know, the pace, it seems like the pace of technology and what we need to know and how fast things are coming out is just accelerating. And like where, you know, going back, you know, it's possible to teach somebody, you know, pretty much all they need to know to be effective as a Windows programmer, maybe in 60 hours. But now, you know, the breadth of what's available and what's out there is just, it seems like, you know, there's so much more. And I'm wondering too about books. It seems like the scope, like Jesse and I are working on a Windows 8 book and we're thinking of, you know, like the book needs to ship in a reasonable amount of time and things rev on a pretty quick cycle. And yet you want that level of quality. You know, how do you balance that? Do you think that times have changed to the point where it's harder to ship a quality book and to do completely comprehensive training and things like that?
So it's funny. So you've asked two questions, right? Which is, hey, how do you educate people as fast as technology changes, which is the broader question. And then the more narrow question is, hey, how do books fit into that? And can they fit into that? And on the broad question, I will tell you that in the 90s, we would look at the 60 hours of material and go, this is nowhere near enough. This isn't anywhere close to what they actually need, right? There's so much history. How can anyone come to Windows programming these days? And now I look at how simple things were back then compared to now, right? I mean, when I was at Microsoft, you know, I as a programmer growing up in the native world, right? I knew the native Win32 APIs. I knew that WinForms was just a thin wrapper. And I knew that if I ever needed to, I could drop down to the Win32 API and make make API calls and do things. And I have been to pinvoke.net more times than I can count, right? So that I could do that. But I've met brand new programmers right out of college that came to Microsoft who only learned .NET. They only learned a managed programming environment. And they avoided the Win32 API like the plague. It scared them, terrified them. Right? If they had to call a Win32 API, then they thought they were doing something wrong. And so what happens in my experience is, you know, the history gets lost, right? You just get a generation of programmers that can only build on top of, you know, whatever the current thing is. And then they build their history from there. They just don't have the experience. And to be fair, right? I mean, I started on, you know, C, C++, Win32 APIs, and then I moved to MFC and then .NET. But I never had to do, for example, assembly language programming on Win32. And that would scare me if I had to do that, right? Whether it was inline assembly or just regular old assembly language programs. And you know, people just start with the history wherever they start, and they try to make it work. And, yeah.
And we used to argue that you couldn't be a good C programmer unless you knew assembly.
Right.
And in fact, when I wanted to learn assembly, the fellow who was going to teach it to me, Skip Gilbert, who was one of these great assembly programmers and did, I don't remember if you, know if you remember KB Fix, which was the thing that fixed the caps lock, problem on old Microsoft. That's good. On old IBM computers, you would hit the caps lock and then everything would be backwards from the way you wanted when you hit the shift key. So anyway, he was going to teach me C, and his requirement of me was first that I spend 3 months learning assembly. And so when I got to pointers, it was like, well, why is this hard? You know,
it just made perfect sense. And it's funny, I learned C without learning x86 assembly, right? I took assembly courses in college, mm-hmm. and I could make my assembly language programs work, but I never wrote for real assembly language programs, right? I started with C as my for real program. Actually, I started with AppleSoft Basic, but that's neither here nor there. I never really wrote assembly language for real. And so when I hit pointers in C, that hurt my brain, right?
Yes.
And for you, you're going from 6 pointer types down to 1. And for me, I'm going from no pointer types to 1. And that was a huge leap. And that took me probably a month to get my head around.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't need to spend 3 months learning assembly language, Jesse. Sorry.
Yeah, well, there you go. Fair enough. and your point, your bigger point was that those layers are no longer necessary. It is possible to come in and be a world-class programmer without getting down to the metal these days.
Well, so it depends. I think, you know, the answer to all these questions is it depends, right? If you're writing, you know, HTML, and a website, you can build a great website without ever knowing anything about Windows. Or even if you're writing it on Windows, you can write a great website without ever knowing anything but .NET and ASP.NET, right? But if you're writing an operating system, people still do that, right? For fun, in this case, right? In a lot of cases. If you're writing, you know, a consumer game, right? If you're writing at that level, although even so, at that level, you know, those programmers tend to segregate themselves, right? There's the engine guys who are trying to take maximum advantage of the hardware. And then there's the game guys, right, who write all the levels and the logic in the levels. So it depends on what you're doing in terms of what you need to know. For another example, at Telerik, we write a product called Just Code, which is a code productivity tool, right? It reads all of your code and analyzes it and says, hey, you know, the code could be better if you did this, or, you know, the set of naming conventions that you've set up for this project, you're violating, or, and press a little button and we'll fix it for you, right? That kind of thing. It turns out to be very difficult to hire programmers who are able to write code to analyze other code, right? That is not a problem you generally get when you're building an e-commerce website, right? So it the answer is it depends just how low level you need to go.
No, that's I can't even imagine what it takes to write something like Just Code. But let me bring you back to John's question about books. You just published Building Windows 8 Apps with JavaScript. And so clearly you still believe that books have a place in the myriad ways that people learn new technology. But is this your last book?
So I put in the acknowledgments that this is my last book.
Okay.
This is number 14. Number 13, lucky number 13, was never even published. So I've had, depending on how you count, 13 published books. I've written 14, but then I've contributed to others. I don't really count those. But I've written too many. At this point, right, a friend of mine, before I wrote my first book ever, Dan Weston, was a contractor at Intel. And he said, Chris, a book is a 600-page resume. And after 13 600-page resumes, I think I can be done. And the reason I'm stopping from writing books isn't because I think that there's no place for books. And in fact, it would be strange for me to think that, since I'm also a series advisor on the Microsoft Windows development series from Addison Wesley. So I do think there's a place for books, but I think that place is changing. I don't think books need to be references to APIs anymore or references to big libraries filled with techniques. In fact, when I wrote Building Windows 8 Apps with JavaScript, I wrote kind of from a editorial point of view, from a here, let me introduce you to the concepts. Let me point out the important capabilities. Let me show you how to get started writing, you know, programs for Windows 8 and, you know, using the contracts and how contracts work and using the file system and doing network IO. And let me show you the kind of the big ideas and how to program against those big ideas. And then, you know, not only did I pepper the footnotes with, and for more details, go here, here, and here, but I also said, you know, the web is filled with wonderful resources on this technology from out of the box, right? Microsoft has done an amazing job with their set of samples. They've done a much better job with Windows 8 documentation than they've ever done on any of their technologies before. In fact, I remember when I was learning COM and the documentation would actively lie to you. I learned to avoid documentation by reading the COM documentation. And now, you know, the set of resources on the web means that a book is kind of a view over a technology taking into account all of those resources on the web. It's kind of the timeless version, whereas, you know, the web is constantly changing and growing, right? If that makes any sense.
Okay, before I let you go, how are you keeping up with everything? Your VP at Telerik, which is, one would argue, a full-time job.
And I would like to cut it down to full-time if I could, actually.
And there's all this emerging technology. So how are you keeping up?
Yeah, so what I do is I use a trick that I recommend to kind of everyone in the management hierarchy at the developer tools division at Telerik. And what I recommend is set aside some time every single week for coding. And I do that on my calendar. I actually set up a block of time. And then during the week, so this is kind of breakthrough for me, because it used to be, you know, if I wasn't programming, I'd feel guilty because I was sliding in my technical skills. On the other hand, when I was programming, I'd feel guilty because I was, you know, sliding on all my managerial duties, right? So just the act of saying, I am going to have a block of time, and it's the same time every week. It's on Friday. And if it keeps, if I really hit a groove, I can keep going right through the weekend. And so what I do is I say during the week, I think to myself, ooh, I should really write a program that does X. And I know Friday's coming. That means that I can do it on Friday and I can set aside time on Friday and then I can get back to whatever management, you know, I'm doing. Vice versa, if I'm actually coding, I can say, you know what? They can wait. They can wait till Monday, right? I will get back to them probably Sunday evening. I'll catch up on my email, right? But I am going to take this time on Friday and write some code. And unless I do that, I feel guilty all the time for not coding when I'm not coding or coding when I'm coding. It just is crazy.